Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
All right, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
How are you doing this week, Katie?
I'm okay. You?
I'm really good.
Wow. Why are you so good? What's happening?
So remember how I told you about that new strategy about just sort of not following the news?
Yeah, a couple months ago.
Yeah, I don't know when it was exactly. I just sort of had this new idea about I'm not going to pay attention unless I have to thing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I'm just so much happier. I don't go on social media. And
you don't? What do you do with all your time?
I mean, relatively rarely I go on social media now. And look, we went to war last week and I didn't even know about it for a long time. And that, on the one hand, that's fucked up. On the other hand, it's
yeah, but to be fair, that's not on. I mean, I don't want to give you too much credit. I feel like you're kind of humble bragging for ignoring the war coverage. But
no, I know. It's terrible. I feel bad. But
you're implying that there is war coverage.
Oh, there wasn't?
Barely.
Oh, well, see, I didn't know that.
Oh, right. You wouldn't know that because you wouldn't know. I get it. Yeah. So, but you somehow found out. By the way, I'm going to go on to Matt's Twitter, see how true this is, that he hasn't been on social media. He
Not
did
much.
Say relatively.
Yeah.
What's your Wilson? We should figure out what's Matt's tweet per hour situation right now. Let's see. I'm going on to his.
I mean,
day.
I do it when I got to post something, but I go days without being on.
Oh yeah, you're right. What's today's? Your last one besides that was June 28th.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, Matt, I'm impressed.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And I can feel myself becoming like a slightly less shitty person with each passing.
Yeah,
moment.
your Grinch heart is expanding.
Definitely.
Just
don't do it.
Just don't tweet.
It's like don't eat
like
not eating cheeseburgers or smoking cigarettes. Like your brain unclouds.
I'm actually really
except
surprised.
Except for this show.
Right. This show is where you get where your brain clouds.
No. You should definitely make time to listen.
Oh, I see. Watch the show.
Yeah. Go on the internet and spend as much time as you can watching and rewatching.
Yeah.
The
I
show.
Like that. Yeah.
Right.
Watch Useful Idiots. Cloud your brain.
Right. And then give it some time off. You know, take a walk. Hold a child's hand. Preferably yours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or any, yeah. A dog right. paw.
A dog paw.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Someone tweeted out how much Joe Rogan mentioned to you.
Oh yeah, again.
Anyway, that's really just my attempt to reach out to Joe Rogan and say, Joe, we know you love Matt. You mention him all the time. Maybe you like me. We haven't met. We haven't really corresponded, but it's enough. Your love for Matt, your mutual love for Matt, is enough to justify your coming on the show. So I on behalf of Matt Taibbi.
Right. He would never come on the show.
How do you know?
He just wouldn't. So that's why I'll never ask.
Well, you see what you're doing there, Matt? 100% of the shots not taken never make it into the basket. Am I right, guys? Wilson,
yes,
am I right?
But yeah, on the other hand, shot selection in basketball, that's why you don't take shots you're not going to make.
Well, all right. I will say this, though. Matt Taibbi's very culturally Catholic thing, shtick, makes it so he does think, besides Rogan, I do get the sense that you think it's like asking people a favor to come on the show, which does crack me up. I mean, it is, but people also want to come on the show.
Yeah, occasionally.
Matt's like, apologies. Would you like to come on the show? Apologies.
Yeah, it is. I literally do that.
You do that. I saw a forwarded email and you were like, I mean, it wasn't released. It wasn't like leaked. You just forwarded it to me so we'd have like the logistics about a taping. And it's like, do you want to come? Do you want to come on? Totally get it if you don't want to.
I do.
You're negging yourself. Did you date that way when you were single? Were you like, would you want a drink? I totally get it if you don't want to. You probably don't want to.
No,
I mean, why did I even ask?
Definitely not. No.
All right.
No. That's different.
That's different, right? Well, you need to approach booking our show the way you approach dating.
No, I don't. Nobody wants that.
Okay, maybe not. What's a middle ground?
Or somebody else can do all the booking.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, but why don't you practice on me? Pretend I'm Joe Rogan. Let's just practice. There.
Okay. Here I am doing nothing. I'm not. See?
You won't even ask in a role play.
Right. Why would I?
What if you just practice? We can't
put this on the show.
I don't know. I think this could really get Rogan on.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
Matt, I think, what if I'm going to find out. We got to get this. What if the one thing between Joe Rogan coming on Useful Idiots and the status quo is Matt's invite?
In all seriousness, in business, there's a finite number of things you can ask of people. So you have to be selective about those things.
Oh, and since he's had you on your show, I get it if you don't want to ask him to come on our show. I get it. But luckily for you, there's another show called The Katie Halper Show. And what you can do is just ask for that one, because I totally get it if you feel awkward.
He doesn't do interviews. I've talked to him about this. He doesn't do interviews. Like, enough of them have worked out badly that they...
Oh, yeah. I'm kidding. I don't really expect him to come on the Katie Halper Show. Anyway.
Yes, no, I'm very Catholic about asking people favors.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm self-hating. I have to confess my sins all the time.
Yeah, exactly. It was so funny. I totally get it if you don't want to come on, but if you do want to come on, you know, come on.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. So anyway, I feel better.
Good.
And but now let's get into all the shitty things that I didn't pay attention to this week.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of them, right?
So much. Yeah. A lot of them. Yeah. So should we just jump into the four? Should we just binge?
Let's just go straight into the
binge on those four food groups. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In Democrat Sucking, we have a story about Nina Turner, friend of the show. As people are aware, she's running for Congress to replace Marsha Fudge. Marsha Fudge, by the way, just a reminder, she is a Black former member of Congress from Ohio. She said that she was tired of Black people just being considered for Department of Labor and HUD. Mm. And Joe Biden delivered and named her to HUD. So mm-hmm. she is now at HUD. Because Joe Biden likes,
that's kind of messed up on both their parts, actually.
Yeah, it's true. It is a double own. I'm going to blame Biden more than her, because I think it's hard to turn down a cabinet position.
Yes, I guess so.
Yeah, but I mean, it would be great for her to be principled.
I mean, I would have gone into the private sector and made 50 times the money.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Nina Turner.
Then again, if you don't take the cabinet job, then you're not going to later get the bigger private sector
exactly.
job.
Yeah, that's how the revolving door works, right?
So, yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah. So Nina Turner, who was a state senator of Ohio, also, as people probably know, Bernie Sanders' surrogate, and then a Bernie Sanders campaign chair. Bernie Sanders for president. She's running on a platform of Medicare for all and a living wage, housing as a human right. And she is polling at 50% in the 13th candidate primary for Ohio's 11th district. Dave Sirota and Julia Rock have a great article, "Dems Launch Proxy War on Medicare for All. Dems Bankrolled by Big Pharma Are Suddenly Targeting Nina Turner," right after she aired an ad touting Medicare for All. Obviously, she's a threat to the status quo because she supports those good things. And this means that what has to happen because of that? Obviously, House Majority Whip James Clyburn, who is, by the way, among the top recipients of pharmaceutical industry PAC money in both the House and Senate. Okay, that's a pretty big deal, right? He's a member of the House. He's a congressman, but he's the biggest recipient of all of them.
Oh, I was going to say, like, is he somehow both in the Senate as well? But,
Yeah. So he joined luminaries like Hillary Clinton in supporting candidate Chantel Brown. And he told the New York Times, "What I try to do is demonstrate by precept and example how we are to proceed as a party." Now, Clyburn also, of course, famously intervened for.
Well, he decided the presidency.
He decided the presidency, basically, right?
Yeah.
So I want to, sometimes we do the Useful Idiots bump where we claim credit for something. We have a couple of those this week, but I think that one of them this week that we can claim is that Clyburn did not endorse Nina Turner, because that would have been a terrible stain on her campaign to have such a corporate shill.
Oh, you're trying to like reverse mindfuck him, right?
Well, it's like when Alan Dershowitz like endorsed Tom Perez and threatened to leave the Democratic Party if Keith Ellison became the DNC chair. It's like, that is the best endorsement of
right,
Keith Ellison.
Yeah. That's
I've
sort
ever
of a
seen.
don't throw me in that there Brer Patch kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. So, but I thought, you know, we are talking about Democrats suck, and sadly, the New York Times is. How would you describe the relationship between the New York Times and Democrats?
Inseparable? I don't know. Yeah. Identical? I mean, I don't even view them as a different institution,
right.
Actually.
So I thought it'd be worth reading the article that the New York Times put out on this story, because it's one of those things where it's kind of meta. It's not just the story. It's not just that Clyburn comes out of, you know, the woodwork to endorse Nina Turner's opponent. It's also the way it's presented by the media. Number three House Democrat steps into Ohio race to head off a Sanders acolyte, which I think is an interesting way of putting it. The decision by Representative James Clyburn to oppose an outspoken ally of Senator Bernie Sanders in a special election in Cleveland highlights the generational and ideological gulf in the Democratic Party. Now, in a way that's honest, right? Because he's framing it as a Sanders-related battle. And I think that for so many people, this is about Sanders. It's also about, much like the Sanders thing, it's about like progressive issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a little bit weird. I don't know. What do you think? Acolyte? I think it's a weird thing to describe her as.
I mean, I wouldn't. I'm not sure if I would love it if I were her, but.
You think it's like an accurate description, or?
It depends. I mean, you're shorthanding it for an audience that's not a Cleveland audience, so it's
right.
Technically right. That's tough. I don't know. I mean, it's a little weird.
That's a little weird, right? I mean, acolyte. What is it? It's a person assisting the celebration in a religious service or procession.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a pawn. Like,
no, it's not a pawn. I don't know. There's something weird, I think, and judgmental about it. Like, well, especially because the New York Times hates Bernie Sanders so much. So,
right. Well, again, they're framing this for their audience, which,
oh right,
which
yeah,
they think hates Bernie Sanders. So they're. That's why they're trying to play this up, because they want people to click on the story.
Yeah, I get it. It's right. So, but here's what I like about this story. And it was written by Jonathan Weissman,
mm-hmm.
who's also a novelist, apparently.
What kind of novels?
Jonathan Weissman is a congressional correspondent, veteran Washington journalist, and author of the novel Number 4 Imperial Lane and the nonfiction book Semitism, with three parentheses, you know, around Semitism, that word. Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. His career in journalism stretches back 30 years.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, we should have him on.
How many journalists have successfully made the jump and have actually become good novelists?
I don't know.
I mean, there's plenty, actually. You know, Michael Connelly, if you like detective novels.
Oh, yeah. Then there are lawyers who become novelists, right? But that's a different one.
There's some Russians I can think of.
Of course, Matt. Why does your head go there?
Sorry. A lot of people start out as, we'll have to come back to that subject. Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, so here's, I mean, basically the split between Turner and her opponent, Chantel Brown, is, you know, between the two wings of the Democratic Party. So you see this in the endorsements also. So the so Nina Turner was endorsed by AOC, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib. And then on the other hand, Chantel was endorsed by Clyburn, Hillary Clinton, Richard Cordray, Representatives Joyce Beatty of Ohio, and the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus, and moderate Democrats like Representative Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey and David Schoen of Maryland. One second, though. Let's just pause there. Josh Gottheimer is not moderate. He's like a Trump Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
He's a totally right wing. He's not moderate.
Okay.
He's bad on everything. Like, he's Trumpy on everything, from the border to, you know, salt. He's obviously really bad on that. Actually, that would make him non-Trumpy, right? You know him. You've written about him in your anti-Semitic attack.
That's right. That's right. I forgot I was an anti-Semite because I was writing about his fraternity that I didn't.
Yeah. No, it was Jewish.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Yeah. It's the other way. He's not Trumpy.
No, he's Trumpy.
Except on the salt thing.
Yes, right. So ignore that part. And that is like an exception because even Trump is an exception on that, right? Like, because Trump happens to be on the right side of that for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, he was just doing it to mess with the Democrats.
Right, yeah.
Again, respect the work, but.
Yeah, yeah. Good hustle, yeah.
Right.
No, he's awful. Like, he pushed for Trump's border wall. He backed the budget for funding the border wall. He's a total hack.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not a moderate. I mean, I don't like moderates. So I'm not, I have no skin in the game. He just happens to not be moderate. Like for me, it's an insult to be moderate anyway.
Right.
But he's not a moderate. Okay. Anyway, just wanted to clarify that, Jonathan, from one Jew to another. But this is my favorite part of the article, which says, to this day, some Democrats say Ms. Turner's hostility cost Mrs. Clinton key votes on the left in the swing states that decided the 2016 election.
Oh my God. That's not quoting anybody? Who else was quoted in that piece?
Let's see. Turner, surprisingly enough.
No. Like quoted some, who talked to Wiseman?
I'm looking right now. Let's see. We got.
A little clue, folks. This is how you do sleuthing about where stuff came from.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm looking. Let's see. All right, so obviously Clyburn.
When something is not like a rote observation, like it was, the sky was blue on Thursday, and there's like a sort of an opinion in the piece. Okay. To this day, some Democrats say Ms. Turner's hostility cost Ms. Clinton key votes on the left in the swing states that decided the 2016 election. Okay. This reporter is this guy, Wiseman, right?
Yeah.
He's not going to just say that. Okay. He's not going to just put that in the piece. He also doesn't want to tell you where it came from. But when you're reading an article like this, just look at who the quoted people are in the article and then sort of do the math yourself.
Yeah.
Unless there's an unnamed source, but usually they'll refer to that as well. They'll say
right.
Four people familiar with the situation, right. Whatever it is. But here it's an on the record Jim Clyburn. So this is Jim Clyburn talking, but not talking, right? And which is like a gift that reporters will give to an interview subject. This is sort of like the I scratch mine, my back, you scratch yours thing. Like I'll give you the interview, but you got to sort of speak with my words a little bit. It's not an explicit thing. It's just something that's done. That's Clyburn saying, I want you to say that Turner lost the election for Hillary
right.
in 2016, which is like pretty messed up.
It's really messed up. But I kind of assume that look at friend of the show, Sydney Melbourne, Sydney Ember. That's really funny. I call her Cindy Melbourne because Australian city. No, but look at this. I mean, if we take
Sydney Melbourne, I like that.
if we should call her that.
No, we should have a Sydney Melbourne detective series, like Detective Sydney Melbourne.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. Like, I actually think that the New York Times is very capable of just putting in its own opinion and pretending it's fact.
No, they wouldn't do that. Not in this case.
Really?
I'm going to say
isn't that
98% of that, that came from Clyburn.
Huh.
Either that or his aide.
Okay.
It's whoever set up the interview.
Right.
Or but Clyburn.
So is it because you think it's beneath the New York Times? Well, which is worse, actually? Which is worse, do you think?
No, this is worse. This is little fourth wall stuff.
Yeah.
Like, so when you're doing stories like this, you're whoever you're talking to, there's obviously lots of dialogue that doesn't go into the story between you and whoever the sources are, like whoever alerts you to whatever it is. Sometimes it might be like a member of somebody's staff. They want you to do a story on X. I'll get you an interview with my person. Then you have a little talk about what the issues are, right? So all that stuff becomes internalized in your mind. The reporter is not going to make an observation like that on his or her own. That 100% comes from somebody. And it's just a way of kind of like massaging your interview subjects a little bit. You're throwing them a little favor.
Got it.
So, and you can, in the business, everybody does this stuff where you try to deduce where things came from. Like, that's where it came from.
Right.
So.
Oh, you know what? this guy, I remember he was demoted by the New York Times because he tweeted, saying Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar are from the Midwest is like saying Lloyd Doggett is from Texas or John Lewis is from the Deep South.
Aren't they all?
Yeah.
What's the problem? I'm sorry.
Oh, it just, he's trying to suggest that these people don't represent the areas that they're from, I think. Oh, fuck you, dude. Sorry, dude. Okay, this guy fucking sucks. He tweeted, Justice Democrats has backed, this is from, this guy is sucks so hard. Sorry, August 2019. This is amazing. Hold on. This is amazing. So in August 2019.
Tell me how you really feel.
Sorry. August 2019, he tweets, Justice Democrats has backed another primary challenger. This one seeking to unseat an African-American Democrat. Joyce
Oh, Lee, yeah. There we go.
Who represents Columbus. So guess what? You know why that doesn't work?
Because the challenger is also African-American?
Yes. But you know what? He took it in stride. You know what he did?
What?
When she pointed out, she tweeted, I am also Black.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote back,
congratulations.
No. Endorsement included a photo.
I don't even know what that means. What does that mean?
He's either saying I did nothing wrong or he's saying you don't look sufficiently Black.
Oh no, I think he's saying that I let everybody know that by including the photo. Oh,
okay, yeah. So he's just saying I'm a dick and
live with it.
Live with it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is such a, like, no, you were saying to me, no, what do you really think, right? What do you really think, Jonathan Weissman? Like, you're really going to trot out that she's unseating an African-American woman.
It's gross, disgusting politics.
It's so gross. Yeah. Has backed another, how many, that is a talking point. I want to know, like, how many, they love doing that. They do that all the time. And they don't even care, as in this case, if the person who is challenging the other person is Black. Cori Bush challenged a Black man. She's a Black woman. They love doing that. Remember they kept saying that during the primaries that Justice Democrats is targeting people of color? Well, if you target them with other people, first of all, that's not actually the litmus test. There are bad people who are of color. Like there are good people who are of color. There are bad people who are white. There are good people who are white. I know I'm blowing everyone's minds right now, but to like flatten all politics and ideology to identity politics, obviously, or not even identity politics. To
yeah,
identity.
It's not even identity. It's
to identity. It's just ridiculous. Like Clarence Thomas. I wonder if he likes Clarence Thomas, Jonathan Weissman. I hope he does. Right. But, and in fact, he should, everyone who criticizes Clarence Thomas, I hope Jonathan Weissman indicts them for going after a Black justice. See, this is why I think it's totally conceivable that he was saying some Democrats say.
I doubt it.
I think you're giving him too much respect. Isn't this just like the some say?
No, because you're editing. So even some say has to come from somewhere. Like the,
it could be him. He's a Democrat.
Like you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to just drop stuff in stories that aren't attributed to something.
Well, you know what? That's really bad for Nina Turner because you know what Jim Clyburn is?
What?
The most progressive member of Congress.
According
ever.
To?
Jim Clyburn.
Oh.
He actually said there's nobody more progressive than Jim Clyburn.
That's great. I love that.
There ain't nobody in the Democratic Party of the United States of America that's more progressive than Jim Clyburn.
John Weissman, who I'm going to propose to, by the way, because you can tell I really like him. But isn't it also weird that he wrote in this article, in a rare intervention into a party primary, Mr. Clyburn, a veteran lawmaker and the highest ranking Black member of Congress, endorsed Chantel Brown, Ms. Turner's leading opponent? He did that already. Why is that rare?
What do you mean? What?
Sorry. Well, they're saying in a rare intervention into a party primary, Mr. Clyburn endorsed Chantel Brown.
Oh, because he already endorsed her?
Well, no, sorry, because with Bernie Sanders and Biden, it's now like a signature move. In his second rare intervention in a party primary.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, no, I guess. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, if anything, that's the thing that he's known for.
Yeah, so. He pulled a Clyburn.
Right. Right. Interesting.
Jonathan Weissman also quit Twitter. I forgot about that in 2016 over anti-Semitic bullying.
There should be like a people who quit Twitter club. Where are they?
There should be, yeah.
Who's on that list? Freddie DeBoer.
Freddie DeBoer. But he's back, right?
He's back. Yeah.
Enough. Who else?
They always come back.
They always come back. Yeah, Weissman is back. I bet he wishes he stayed off because that's when he did those weird things about, you know, Rashida Tlaib not being from the Midwest.
Yeah.
What a prick. Sorry. What if I had a crush on him this whole time?
That's not apparent. Yeah.
If
that's what's going on, that's pretty fucked
up. No, I'm just thinking, like, I look obsessed. It reminds me of Michelle Wolf during her press, the White House press thing, where she's like, I think you guys maybe have a crush on Donald Trump. You can't stop talking about him.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a bunny boiler thing going on there.
Yeah, I don't know what that means, but I hate him.
Weissman?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can tell. Yeah.
It could be like a Carville Matlin thing.
Right, it's opposites attract kind of a thing. Yeah. I think that marriage is always really, really interesting. Well, actually, no, it isn't. It's actually
they're both so attractive. How obvious. Could they resist? Anyway, whatever. He sucks, and so that sucks. Yeah.
Okay, so for Republicans suck. There was a little bit of a choice this week, Matt. If we could open the story, the House votes to remove Confederate statues in the U.S. Capitol.
Oh yeah, this is a good one.
Okay, so here's the story. House of Representatives on Tuesday voted to remove all Confederate statues from public display in the U.S. Capitol, along with replacing the bust of former Chief Justice of the United States, Roger Taney, author of the 1857 Dred Scott decision that declared that people of African descent were not U.S. citizens. The House passed the measure 285-120. All Democratic members supported the legislation. All no votes came from Republican members. So the number here is 120 people voted to keep the statue of Jefferson Davis in the Capitol. The reasons for this were they were all over the place.
Yeah,
there's a line. Alabama Republican Representative Mo Brooks previewed his no vote on the bill in a statement decrying, quote, cancel culture and historical revisionism, unquote. I support federalism and a state's right to vote for itself, which it honor. It should be whom, right? As such, I will proudly vote no on H.R. 3005. Alabama, not New Yorkers, Californians, or anyone else, should decide who we wish to honor in Alabama's contribution to the national statuary collection. The statement read. There's really not a whole lot to say here, except whatever reason you're coming up with to vote to keep Confederate statues in the Capitol is probably like a bad reason. Just call in sick that day, you know? If you're worried, because I'm sure what it is that you're worried about dog whistling your insane constituents and you don't want them to think you're actually voting against taking down Confederate statues, heaven forbid, right? You know, just don't do it. Like, find a way not to do it.
Right, call in sick. Say that you're paying homage to like Robert E. Lee that day or something. It's like Robert E. Lee Appreciation Day. I don't know.
Exactly.
That you're doing like a national patchwork quilt of the Confederate flag.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That'll keep you busy.
Yeah. Can we click on the image of Taney, please? All right. Can we zoom in on that? See, I'm a Confederate supporter. I'm going to vote to remove that. Like, just look at that face if we just zoom in more. I think that actually we non-Confederate supporters should be nailing that into the wall. Putting it behind a glass, because he's so creepy looking that like, what better a monument? Do you know what I mean? It's like
there's a little bit of a Lincoln thing in the eyes, though, I gotta say.
I guess, but it's the mouth. It's the, first of all, it has a kind of a 1950s bob or like six. He almost has like a Betty Friedan hairdo.
Yeah, but that was a thing with dudes back then.
I guess it was. I just think he's really ugly.
My favorite writer, Nikolai Gogol, had hair just like that.
Oh, okay. Well, no wonder you have a soft spot for this guy's face. All right. So you disagree with my take that it's actually would be good for the Confederate supporters to take him down because he's so ugly.
I guess I can see that take.
In fact, I think that the racists out there who would want to keep him up should be mad at their representatives for voting to who think that they want. See, if they had bold leaders, the bold leaders would be like, we like the Confederacy, which is why we got to take this ugly face down.
Right, because it's just bad PR.
It's bad PR, yeah. It almost makes them look unattractive. It almost ruins the whole Confederacy thing.
I also got to say, making a states' rights argument in this particular issue is a little bit messed up, given the situation.
It's pretty on brand, though, right?
No, I know, but
I mean it's funny. That's a funny concept because it's like obviously, if the guys are voting for the Confederacy like statues, it would be funny if they were like, but the state, you know, they're like the states' rights thing is problematic. Has problematic overtones.
You right. Yes.
Vote to keep them up.
No, I know. It's just it's a little tone deaf.
They're being tone deaf in their endorsement of the Confederacy. They could do a better job.
Right. Yes. Exactly. There are ways to do this. It would be a little bit more media friendly.
I guess that's true. They could, right? I mean, just emphasize the history, the anti-cancel thing, you don't have to do the states' rights thing.
Yeah, you don't have to do it. Or just don't, like, one of the things this reminded me of is, so I used to live right near Gorky Park in Moscow, and there is a fallen, I think it's called the Fallen Monument Park. And so after communism collapsed, they just rounded up all the statues of like Lenin and all the monsters of, you know, Felix Dzerzhinsky, all those horrible people. And they put them in this park where they were all kind of tilting a little bit and overgrowing with weeds. And every now and then I would go in there and I would see these kind of like weird old holdouts sitting in front of a statue to Lenin or Dzerzhinsky or whoever. And you know, they're just sitting in vigil for their lost heroes. Like, do that. You know what I mean? Like, take all these Confederate statues, put them somewhere, and go sit with them in private. Like, I don't know. I think at some point you got to move on a little bit. I think.
Yeah.
You know, when like there's, you know, the people you're talking about were, for instance, no longer part of your government, or I don't know.
Right. Well, there actually is a very interesting argument to be had about how to deal with those monuments. I made a documentary on this monument called The Valley of the Fallen that is to honor the people who died in the people who died fighting on the fascist side of the Spanish Civil War.
The Franco side,
yeah. And there is an interesting discussion because I think you can keep things if you change the context. Like, you can turn things into never again monuments. And I think sometimes it can almost be, there's a danger that you can whitewash history. But clearly in this context, it's not in a never again way.
Well, not if you're keeping them still in the Capitol.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. For a museum, it's good, but yeah.
All right. So that's Republican suck.
So for Isn't That Weird, I thought we could go to do another story about a gender reveal party. This one is very interesting, I would say. You know, we've done stories. I guess what makes this heartwarming is that I was going to say there's no real violence, but that's maybe not true. Let's go to the videotape. This is a gender reveal announcement. I'm going to see if you can figure out, if you can predict which gender is being announced.
This match can be won by pinfall or submission. Take it away, Ralph.
All right, I want a good clean match. Team girl, good clean match. Team boy, all right, good clean match. Nothing dirty here. Here we go. Let's get it on.
Do you have any predictions, Matt? Let me pause this. Can you pause for a second? So for people who are just listening to this podcast, these are two men in a like ring, like an outdoor ring that was just made from a pop-up ring on the grass. And they're both topless and wearing tutus. One is in a pink tutu with pink tights and one is in a blue tutu with blue tights. Okay.
And there's they're sort of hurling each other. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's an umpire referee.
It's a girl.
Okay, the girl's on top at that point. Okay.
Oh no, she got. Oh, I see.
They're good, right?
Yeah, they are good. Yeah.
Then the guy walks in with a... So a guy walked in with a chair and swatted one on the back.
Nice.
These are all WWE moves, right?
Yeah.
Get back alive!
And a flock of there pink over the blue.
One, two,
three.
It's a girl.
So it's right, a girl.
I like that one.
Yeah, it's good, right? I guess for isn't that special. I like it also because it's like plays with gender stuff in a cool way.
Yeah.
It's like both like totally, you know, boring and blue is male, pink is girl, you know, blue is boy, pink is girl, but at the same time there are two men wrestling in tutus. So it's like as subversive as you can be while still being, you know, too gender limited.
That part of it was less funny for me, but
yeah.
But it's all.
What are you laughing at? The chair?
No. It's all good. Yeah, I wonder who scripted that.
Yeah, it's pretty well scripted, right?
Yeah. It was well done. It was very well done. So isn't that terrible? Well, I love it. So Matt, if we could see the CBS News story. Spectator who caused massive crash at the Tour de France, missing after fleeing the country. So the story is a spectator at the Tour de France who caused a massive crash involving dozens of cyclists is missing as race authorities plan to sue her. Tour de France deputy director Pierre-Yves Touol told the AFP news agency, isn't that redundant? Agence France-Presse, agence? I don't know.
Yeah.
Sorry. They plan to sue the
They
woman.
Want to give a lot of agency to them, though.
I guess so. They plan to sue the woman so that the tiny minority of people who don't do this don't spoil the show for everyone. However, French publication West France reported the woman, who is believed to be German, got on a flight and is untraceable, according to CBS Sports. At this point, you just want to scroll down and see the video because it's awesome. So, Matt, if we could just take a look.
Yeah, and then we should describe it off of her.
So it's the Tour de France stage. All these cyclists are starting out. They're cycling and...
What's going to happen? How many people are going to get back up?
Right, that
this?
Sign right
on
there,
your left
Phil.
Do your picture. Oh my goodness, May. Oh.
So this woman, she's holding a sign out into the street, and basically knocks
down.
Over a cyclist.
Yeah, causing
a massive domino effect. It's like a huge pileup. Nobody died or was seriously hurt, but it was bad.
Still terrible.
Yeah.
Because it involves now she's a fugitive.
Yeah, well, so that's hilarious that she's like on the run forever. I was thinking about this after seeing this story. There are really, did you know, Katie, that I was once a sports editor?
Where? Buffalo? Moscow?
No, also in Moscow. Yeah, I was the sports editor of the Moscow Times. So I had to do sports all the time. In fact, one of the reasons I laughed at the story is that I worked for a European boss who ordered me to do cycling stories all the time, even though I didn't think anybody was interested in them. But having done a lot of sports and watched all sports, there's really two categories of fan interference stories. And they can both be like dramatic, life-altering events. The first version, and Katie, do you know about the Steve Bartman incident?
No.
This is a fan, and remember, the Chicago Cubs at this point had not won the World Series for like forever, okay? And this is a playoff game.
Again in the air, down the left field line, a long reaching into the stands and couldn't get it, and he's riddled with a fan.
So there's a guy here named Steve Bartman. Reaches up to catch the ball.
That's awfully close to fan interference right there.
Oh, shit. So just for people who are just listening, right? It was a ball was hit.
A ball was hit.
Flying. A ball was hit, and the guy is trying to catch it.
Yeah, the third baseman went down the third baseline. The third baseman was going to catch the pop-up, except the fan reached over and sports fans know this incident. It's famous.
Okay.
Our friend Alex Gibney made a movie about this incident, actually.
Oh, wow. Let's have him on the show.
Because this guy had to go into hiding, just like the Tour de France woman, Steve Bartman. So the cutting to the chase there, the Cubs had not won basically in forever. This was a crucial out in a playoff game. If he doesn't touch the ball, the Cubs probably catch it and they maybe win the game because he touches it. It's fan interference, and they get another. And essentially, the Cubs go on to lose. So the whole city of Chicago wanted to kill this person who right. probably just was instinctively thinking, "I want to catch the ball," but or didn't know the rule, one or the other, right? So that's
I wouldn't have known the rule.
Right, exactly. So
but there's he reached over, right? It's totally kosher to catch it if it comes to you, right? Once it's over the fence.
Yeah, I forget the exact
it's self-defense rule. At that point.
You can't get in the way of the player.
I see, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm surprised that player didn't like freak out more.
Well, he probably couldn't reach him.
No, I mean cursing. Like you see him cursing,
he did. But he doesn't really curse. I mean he probably if he had well, that okay, then that brings us to the next category of fan incident. You know, when the fans, sometimes the players and the fans, things get completely out of line and they intentionally sort of try to interfere with the outcome, which is even worse. So like, for instance, the Cleveland Browns / Unicorns.
Fortunately, those bottles are plastic.
It's the end of a football game.
But these Cleveland fans,
Browns
are
fans, are
irate.
Mad at the referees, so they're throwing bottles on the field. They won't stop.
And they're trying to.
The Browns are going to lose.
Clear the end zone, and now they're going to call.
That
the
is
game.
The end of the game.
The referees call the game.
Now they call the game.
Well, that was the right
for the against the Browns.
Yeah, you got to take.
The fans go crazy.
This has been.
And they start throwing even more stuff.
Just a fiasco by the referees today.
Well, that.
And jeez, these officials that really need to get off the field.
And you know what? The fans got to stop throwing crap. We just saw a guy get hit in the head and he's down, split his head wide open. The fans have got to control themselves. People are getting hurt. It's ridiculous. You're only hurting yourselves by throwing stuff on the field.
So, and anyway.
Officials are.
Wasn't there also a.
There's like a million of these. There's like NBA one where they, you know.
No, but there was like a soccer player who I think scored an own, you know, a self goal or whatever it's called.
An own goal, yeah.
And was killed.
Was he? I didn't hear about that.
I
fans
so.
Killed him? Well, you know, pay more attention when you're playing.
Seriously, yeah. Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
But well, you know what? What we just saw doesn't surprise me because this type of behavior is very embedded into our culture. It's very entrenched. This is how, it's not surprising that people respond that way to professional games when this is a viral video of people at a Little League game.
Nice.
Hey!
They clip out the curses.
This is a kid's game. Where's my
So people taking things a little too seriously.
Yeah.
Oh, so you're trying to say that people, because people take sports too seriously, that they, it's no surprise to you that they would do things like split somebody's head open with a bottle?
Yeah. I mean, if that's how they respond to like a Little League game.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, but yeah, I could make the more anti-sports argument, but I don't want to do that because I'm already in, on thin ice with sports people. I can't piss them off. Because
right.
I know so much about sports that it triggers them.
I mean, I think let's just put our cards on the table. It's not appropriate to act like that with a kid's game. But if, you know, you're a referee and you call a game prematurely, you should, you know, your life should be at stake. I think that's, you know, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
It matters. So I do feel for the Tour de France lady.
Yeah, me too.
She's German.
Right. But you know what? The first bicyclist to fall, apparently, was a German, too.
Really?
So if this was some kind of espionage, it didn't work. Or she's self-loathing. Yeah.
Right. Wonder where she's going to end up.
Belgium.
That's a pretty funny
Switzerland.
Thing.
Like, Switzerland. Because it's neutral.
Neutral. Now, there's lots of cycling fans in Switzerland. I think she's going to have to go to someplace like Arizona.
Ooh.
You know what I mean?
Do we really wish that on her?
No, but I mean, nobody's going to recognize her. Like, they don't even know
right.
what the Tour de France is there.
Right.
You know?
Unless they watch Useful Idiots, in which case we just blew her cover.
Right. Right. So we'll put a picture of her up on when we tweet
to
show up. So that's.
I mean, no one died again. Like, the guy who won got to dramatically cross the finish line with some blood on his knee.
Yeah. Everybody get over themselves.
Yeah, get over
themselves. It's not like the Cubs situation. That mattered.
Yeah. I think she should be made an honorary French citizen.
Yeah, they should, more than that, they should give her a house in Paris.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the food groups this week. We have a really interesting interview coming up with Austin Smith, who is has one of the more unusual biographies of a Useful Idiots guest. He's a former Onion writer and lawyer who is known as the Don Quixote of student loans for a really interesting reason that we're going to get to. And he's also running for Congress in the first congressional district in New York, which is Eastern Long Island, just announced his campaign. Super interesting guy. He, I came across him because I'm writing a story about this phenomenon in student loans that a lot of people don't know about. But if you have student loans, you probably want to hear this because you might be eligible to discharge them and not know it. So he's a funny guy and very, very interesting. So let's have a listen. Thanks for doing this.
You bet. Thanks for inviting me. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Can you tell us a little? You're running for Congress in the New York's first congressional district, which is Eastern Long Island, Hampton, Sag Harbor, Montauk. We're going to get to you have an extremely unusual biography.
Yeah.
But we're going to get to all of that. But can you talk about your
Robert
campaign?
Mueller?
So, you know, I guess when COVID hit in March last year, I was living in Manhattan and I actually moved down to DC. I was seeing a woman and that sort of unfortunately fell apart, but I was down there until about September. And then, you know, that sort of fell apart. So I came back to New York. I was sort of looking for an apartment and, you know, New York City in September was kind of, it was like sort of The Walking Dead, you know, it was still pretty sort of, it was a ghost town and it was kind of creepy. And parts of that were kind of fun, but parts of it I thought were a little depressing. So I went out and stayed with a buddy in East Hampton for a weekend. And I was just sort of like, you know, this is a little nicer. This is a little calmer, a little sort of less, you know, post-apocalyptic. So I rented a house in East Hampton in September and was there through March. Then I came back into the city. But it was during that time that, a couple things happened. Number one, so, you know, I was living out in the district and, you know, just sort of picking up the newspapers and I kept seeing this guy, Lee Zeldin, who I sort of frankly hadn't been familiar with. And, you know, I used to work in Republican politics, so I sort of got his sort of shtick pretty quickly. You know, it was sort of this right wing sort of fake free market sort of is going to save us thing. But, you know, still, that isn't enough to sort of launch a campaign for Congress against somebody because there's a lot of them and you'll sort of, that's unfortunately, you know, you can't sort of fix that. But then when January 6th happened, I was actually in D.C. on that day, oddly enough, you know, sort of do a fair amount of work through my law practice that sort of requires me to be in D.C. So I was in D.C. that day. And I think like most of us, you know, it was pretty terrifying. I think it what was odd for me is at first it sort of felt pretty cartoonish. You know, it sort of had this sort of opera buffoon quality to it. Like it was so stupid. And like these sort of costumes were also ridiculous that it didn't really seem like right in the beginning. I thought, oh, well, this is just stupid. It's sort of this play acting and it's not really, there's no sort of real risk here. And then I don't know if it was a combination of sort of really good editorials or like the sort of severity of it had sort of been kind of hidden from sort of the public. But that evening and then into the following days, you know, I started sort of reading some of the coverage and seeing some of the footage. And it sort of moved from sort of comic into a little bit more tragic, I thought, and quite mesmerizing and terrifying at the same time. And the biggest thing for me, frankly, was, you know, that the RNC, even after January 6th, you know, they were still polling that. They were still seeing if that was going to play. And I could sort of tell that. I mean, you could tell just by reading their fundraising solicitations, looking on their website, they were very clearly not distancing themselves from it.
They were gathering information, basically.
And I was just went out of my mind. And I knew some people at the RNC and I started reaching out to them and say, take that fucking website down. What the hell's wrong with you? Like, even putting aside whatever you think of sort of the merits of what happened, you guys committed the ultimate sin, according to your leader, which is you lost. So drop it, you know? And I was absolutely furious, like a lot of people were. that just sort of stayed with me. And then I came back to New York. And then I started seeing, you know, I assumed, I didn't really know what was going to happen, but I assumed like there was going to be a mass sort of expulsion of people in Congress who sort of had participated in this. And then there wasn't. And I was sort of like, well, I guess that's a little bit to be expected. But then it was like the people who were participating in it didn't have any shame about it. Like they were still sort of like pushing their narrative. And, you know, I'm all for sort of freedom of speech and all that. But, you know, there's also sort of some taking responsibility for what you've done, I think, a component to that, which I did not see happening. And so that was, that really got my blood boiling. And I was really like, well, who, like this guy seemingly thinks that he's going to be able to not only remain a congressman, but he's going to run for re-election and he's going to sort of somehow use the failed insurrection, like almost as a, like proof of how sort of tough he is on Republican principles. Like this is just, we have moved into really, I think, the reductio ad absurdum of this sort of, you know, this charade. That was when I was like, all right, you know what? If no one else is going to run against this guy, then I have to, if for no other reason than to just spend a year sort of throwing everything I have at him and sort of getting people to recognize what he is.
A patriot.
A patriot. Well, you know, look, I mean, again, I will say, I mean, I don't believe really in any of their principles, but, you know, again, just winning or losing, you know, the founding fathers in some ways were not doing something entirely dissimilar, but they won and you guys lost. And so, you know, there's that scene from, I keep thinking of, you know, there's no better way to sort of paint your political sort of views than with sort of Tom Cruise movies. What's that movie, The Last Samurai? Where like they've lost the battle and
yeah.
That corrupt Japanese guy. And he's like, he must accept his shame. He must like commit suicide. And I sort of feel like that guy, like talking to me, like, what are you doing? He lost, you know, finito. Anyway, so then, you know, I was sort of doing a lot of this sort of student debt work and we were, unfortunately, we kept running our heads against the wall. And, you know, part of the problem was there's just really no penalty for breaking the law in so many instances, you know, and you are in some ways it's relying upon the good faith of the actors because, you know, their litigation, the way it works is, you know, you can put a lot of penalties on the books and you can sort of make a lot of threats. But at the end of the day, you know, a corporation, they can basically, you know, violate the law with impunity for a long time. And when they get caught, they can keep doing it for 5 more years. And then when things finally get a little bit risky, they can just settle. And they always end up settling for less than the value of their illegal conduct. So it's always actually financially a winning combination. And I found that kind of distressing. And so sort of for that reason, I was like, all right, well, you know what, this, we have sort of been in litigation for 6 years and we are not making the type of progress I would like. And so those two sort of things coalesced and I was like, all right, well, if I can both sort of stick it to Lee Zeldin and or try to stick it to Lee Zeldin and sort of find some way to, you know, get into a legislative capacity where I could do something that I haven't quite figured out yet, but I'm sure once they give you sort of the power to create laws, we can find a way to create one that's actually going to have some teeth, I hope. Now that's a little bit prophecy naive because I'm sure a lot of people said that before. As they say, the definition of insanity and the definition of tenacity are pretty much the same thing. Just keep doing it until it works.
Just quickly, before we move on from the student loan issue,
yeah.
So people understand the specifics of this, when we're talking about why these loans might be non-dischargeable, it's because they don't fit in certain
right.
buckets, right? So there are some schools that might not be authorized or like... what's the word I'm looking for?
Accredited,
right, exactly. Or the student might not be full-time, might not actually be a student, or the loans might be for eligible expenses. Like it's something you use after you graduate or at some other time. Can you just talk about some of those things?
Yeah, so I think the way I usually sort of, you know, try to sort of summarize it is, you know, like the bankruptcy code restricts the discharge of federally insured and federally guaranteed educational debt. Okay, so that's sort of the vast majority of educational debt. When it comes to private loans, the term that is actually in the law is what's called a qualified education loan, which comes from the tax code because you also get tax benefits for it. And in order to be a qualified education loan, you have to have at least 3 things. Number one, and you have to have all 3 of them. You can't just have 1 or 2. Number one, you have to be an eligible student under the Higher Education Act. And that generally means you've got to be attending school more than half time. So that cutoff is usually about 6 credits. So if you're only taking 5 credits or less, or you're somehow sort of enrolled less than half time, you're not what's called an eligible student. I mean, you might be an eligible student at the school, and you probably are because they're letting you go to a class, but you're not in a position to incur qualified education debt. And so those loans would be fully dischargeable. The second one is, as you sort of pointed out, eligible schools. So, you know, there are thousands of Title IV accredited schools that the Department of Education has sort of put their stamp of approval on, but there are thousands of schools that are not accredited. And it's not purely sort of these are all really bad schools. I mean, there are certainly a lot of really bad schools, but some of them, you know, are seminaries, and some of them are just sort of schools that don't want to be sort of part of the ecosystem of sort of the Department of Education. So if you're attending one of those, and, you know, they are far more prevalent on the West Coast than on the East Coast, but I mean, California has thousands. And a lot of times these banks started lending to kids at private high schools too. I mean, I actually get a fair amount of students whose it's their parents and they borrowed money for their children's high school, and high schools are just not part of the Department of Education system of higher education. Sort of.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing.
And then the third one is eligible expenses. And sort of that one's a little bit trickier, but, you know, every school that is accredited by the Department of Education has to come up with what's called a cost of attendance. And it's just a sort of, it's a sum of your tuition, room, board, books, living expenses, you know, health insurance. It's sort of a package of how much would it cost the average student to attend this college. And so, you know, it's different for NYU and the University of Nebraska, partly just because it's a lot cheaper to live in Omaha than it is to live in Manhattan. And so when you borrow money through the financial aid office, they will sort of usually put this whole package together, and they'll sort of give you some scholarships, and they'll give you some grants, and they'll figure out some federal loans and a little private money, and they put together a whole package, and you're pretty well protected. But the thing that happened was in about 2001, banks sort of said, well, you know, we are always the last dollar in because the Department of Education is sort of putting up the majority of the money. And, you know, we're not really interested in making $3,000, $4,000 loans. There's not enough of a margin there. So what they started doing was they started just doing direct mail. They were called what are called direct consumer loans. They would just, you know, take their list of customers who had borrowed small loans, you know, to sort of fill the gap between their federal loans and their cost of attendance, and started saying, hey, you need an extra $20,000, $40,000, $80,000. You know, you're a smart kid. You're going to do well. You know, borrow it from us and we'll send the check directly to your fraternity or your dormitory or your apartment or wherever you live. And you could borrow from multiple lenders in a single year. The aggregate limit was $140,000 from banks over a 4-year period. So, you know, that's where you start to run into kids who have borrowed $1 million in student loans. And, wow. You know, I mean, I have a couple clients, you know, who are not doctors or lawyers or Indian chiefs. They just got an undergrad degree, but they were borrowing $40,000 to $50,000 a year. And at 13% interest, you know, 3 years out of school, it's $1 million. And so those loans are dischargeable because they're not for eligible expenses because they were not sort of made through the financial aid office. You know, it's really no different than a credit card. But you think about it, it's like, you know, I think I got a couple credit cards in college. And, you know, remember, I don't know if you got one too, but my limit was $500. That was right. Most my credit would. But these kids were getting $40,000 in cash. I mean, it's just astounding when you think about it. And, you know, what the sort of conservative response is always, well, why would a bank make a loan they know couldn't be repaid?
Because they're non-dischargeable and the bonds are always good.
Right. Well, not only that, but, you know, what I have learned is it's not only the problem that sort of, I think, came about in 2008, where they realized, oh, they're securitizing them and you pass the risk on to the next guy. All you have to do is be able to sell it sort of before the music stops. Well, what they also do is, as long as it's collateralized at Navient, they can borrow against that. And what they do is they artificially keep these loans looking healthy. They intentionally do not default people. So they say, look, we've got $3 billion in assets, which are just, you know, consumer loans in negative amortization that are not being repaid, but are being artificially kept out of default. So Navient can borrow against that from other banks. And so, you know, when I realized that, I was like, oh my God. So they are happy that the loans are growing instead of being repaid because it gives them more collateral to borrow against. This is absolutely out of control, out of control. And so that's when I tried to sort of force them into bankruptcy, because I was like, look, this is a total scam in the sense that, yeah, you might have $5 billion in consumer loans on your books, but the true market, the fair market value of that isn't anywhere near $5 billion because you're never going to collect on it. And a lot of it's been discharged. And so, you know, sort of not to skip into that, but that is what sort of led me to think that this whole thing was actually some kind of new form of Ponzi scheme. And I unsuccessfully tried to sort of drag them into the bankruptcy court and sort of, you know, get the courts to sort of just dismantle them. We weren't able to do that just yet. I don't know that we won't ever be able to do it, but I mean, if you've been through bankruptcy and you've got private loans, it's always worth sort of looking into, because you can generally at least settle them and get on a better payment plan. But if you've got these loans and you've been thinking about bankruptcy, or you're in a position where, you know, you're unable to pay these, if they're private loans, you know, take a look. And there are some lawyers who, you know, this is finally starting to sort of come into the mainstream. And so, you know, when I started doing this, there really weren't a lot of lawyers who were willing to look at it. There are more now. You know, you sort of have to Google around, but, you know, depending on where you live, you can probably find someone who's got a little bit of knowledge about this and hopefully get some help.
It's great stuff. Glad to hear that you're healthy. And,
yeah, I know.
Good luck in your campaign. We'd love to check in with you again.
We are, you know, most of it is about raising money, which is absolutely humiliating experience, and I'm so bad at it. But
we can also just nakedly ask our listeners to give all
the remainder of their money.
Please do go on my website if it's still operational, austinsmith2022.com. We're also going to figure out a way, I think, for people to donate like junk. I'm trying to figure out some sort of creative way to, because people always donate cash, but there's a lot of other stuff you can donate that sort of larger campaigns make use of that they don't really do at a smaller level. And then we can like have us, you know, you donate all your junk to us, and then we'll have some kind of like eBay system sort of on the back end that'll turn that into cash. So we're working on that. So stay tuned.
Like a political cards for kids type of thing.
Something like that. Exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Excellent. Right, you know, right. Excellent.
What's an example of junk? Sorry, just last thing. Just for
thing. So like, you know, anything. I mean, so for instance, like, you know, if I were not the candidate, but I were sort of thinking about donating, you know, I have like a flat screen, an old flat screen TV that's been sitting in the corner for, I don't know, a year. And sometimes it's in a box, sometimes it's not. It's probably worth, I don't know, $200, but it's just sitting there. I could donate that to Austin Smith's political campaign. He could liquidate it. Bam, we got $200.
Well, all
it's
right.
A great idea.
Cool. Yeah.
We love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent.
All right. We got one more thing. Right. Anti-sex, pro-spite, fire, and kind of rummage sale.
Yeah. Junk for cash. Yeah. Political junk for cash. I love it. Excellent. Awesome. Thanks so much. And
Thank you so much.
We'll check in with you again soon.
All right.
Take care.
Bye. That was great.
It was, he's a man after my own heart.
You also like setting things on fire?
Setting things on fire, inability to follow rules.
Right.
Get along with anybody consistently long-term in any one place, but like constantly doing something interesting. Like, the thing about the student loans, this is a really super interesting story. And he was really the only one doing it for a really long time. So it's fascinating.
I was really surprised. I know, obviously, I have a slight admiration of Bernie Sanders, but I really thought he was going to say, like, it was the, you know, student loan stuff, the discourse.
I know you were hunting for that.
Really hunting for it. I kept trying to give him an out.
He's coming from a different place, though. It's not.
I know.
It's not about canceling it. It's about the fact that it's illegal. Like, there's.
Right.
I mean, I think if you asked him, if you had asked him a question, what do you think about student debt generally? He might have had an opinion along those lines, but this is about this one subset of loans that's just illegal, you know?
Yeah.
So, but it's interesting, definitely. And very similar to the kind of 2008 mortgage stuff where these guys were, I think, making a calculation, like we're busted, but we're going to keep doing this for a little while because it's going to keep making us money. And even if we lose a suit, which we're probably not going to, it's not going to be as much as the money we're making. So let's just keep doing it. I think, which is an increasingly common phenomenon in finance. So
yeah, good. I like that. Like, very interesting story. Everything's in it. The drama,
the Gresham novel,
legal thriller.
Gladstone Jones. Gladstone James.
Such a great name. Near tragedy, overcoming health adversity.
Right.
It's like a really weird euphemism for cancer. Health adversity.
Health adversity. I suffer from health adversity.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with health adversity. In other news, Mike Gravel died. The senator from Alaska, wanted to give him an RIP and a shout out. And he ran for president twice. And he read the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record. In fact, it was Tuesday, marked the 50-year anniversary of his doing that. And he was really great during the debates. He gives us, he gave us like a perpetual Democrat suck spiel during the, I think, 2008 primary debate. And he just went after all the Dems for sucking and being a bunch of cowards.
It's like going into the Senate. You know, the first time you get there, you're all excited. My God, how did I ever get here? Then about 6 months later, you say, how the hell did the rest of them get here? And I got to tell you, after standing up with them, some of these people frighten me. They frighten me. When you have mainline candidates that turn around and say that there's nothing off the table with respect to Iran, that's code for using nukes, nuclear devices. I got to tell you, I'm president of the United States. There will be no preemptive wars with nuclear devices. To my mind, it's immoral, and it's been immoral for the last 50 years as part of American foreign policy.
Let's use a little moderator discretion here. Senator Gravel, that's a weighty charge. Who on this stage exactly tonight worries you so much?
Well, I would say the top tier ones. They made statements. Oh, Joe, I'll include you too. You have a certain arrogance. You want to tell the Iraqis how to run their country.
And you know, it's really pathetic. The New York Times called him he called him attention getting and grandstanding in an obit that
even
they
in
wrote.
Death.
Yeah.
Yeah. This guy will do anything to get in the news.
And it's so ironic, of course, because you know, the Pentagon Papers were published by the New York Times. You'd think they'd have a little bit more appreciation for him.
Right. Not these editors.
And they, shout out to the New York Times also for having an obit that was written by someone who's died in 2018. So I get that people pre-write obituaries. In fact, Matt, we have to start doing that for our enemies. But they should have at least like pretended to assign it to someone else.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is not a good look when the person who wrote the obituary has been dead for a while.
Yeah. 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I actually knew somebody who had that job. Who did
obit pre?
It was for TV. The person put obits together for TV, like before they were even sick or anything like that. And like for instance, this person did like 5 different versions of Yeltsin dying because he kept, you know, getting sick over and over again. So they kept redoing the obituary.
Right.
But yeah, it's an interesting job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But did you ever interview him, Mike Gravel?
No.
Oh, he was great. I interviewed him on my show, and I actually had Dan Ellsberg on this week because he, of course, worked with Gravel.
Excellent. Well, check it out at the Kitty Halper Show.
Yeah. And check us out, guys, if you're not already watching us, which you probably are. Make sure you rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe to us on YouTube. And to hear the rest of our interview with Austin, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. And please follow us on Twitter. We have a new Twitter account. It's at Useful Idiot Pod. And keep using that hashtag, Useful Idiots Pod.
That's right. Yeah. And we'll do all those things and stay off social media completely otherwise. Yep. And and we'll see you next week.
Yep. I should write my own book.
Can we hold on 1 second? Yep. Sorry.
Okay. What was that? A mosquito or something?
Some kind of insect.
Did you kill it?
I think so.
All right. Like Obama.
I bet I inhaled it. Anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
But here's my favorite.
This has to go on the show.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.